Nationalism is not to be confused with patriotism, wrote George Orwell in a famous essay, describing the former as reactionary, but the latter as potentially progressive. Today we ask, was Orwell right?
Our mission is to deliver Brexit.
It's what they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job.
And making this country the greatest place on earth.
This will be a victory for real people, a victory for ordinary people, a victory for decent people.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. It's good to know some things don't change after all. A row has broken out in the Labour Party about nationality and patriotism. New leader Keir Starmer declared himself a patriot in a Zoom call with voters, prompting, as is normal with such things of course, a big row on social media. This might sound like a flashback to the greatest hits of the second decade of the century, perhaps because it is. This is one-time Labour leadership contender Owen Smith speaking in 2016.
Well, I think Jeremy, to be honest, doesn't really understand sometimes the way in which people have a very strong, perhaps socially conservative with a small c, sense of place, sense of where they're from.
It must have struck a nerve, because since then Jeremy Corbyn repeatedly went out of his way to demonstrate his patriotic credentials. So while many people on the Corbynite left were critical of Starmer's patriotic zeal, there are countless tweets and videos with Corbyn declaring his love for thy country.
Let me be clear, those who actually love their country would never seek to divide it.
But away from Labour's factional politics, can we dig a little deeper? Where does the idea of patriotism come from? What's the relationship between national identity and the racism and colonialism that mark Britain's history? And should we follow both Corbyn and Starmer in their attempts to give a progressive content to patriotism, rather than rejecting it altogether? Joining us to shed light on these questions is Labour MP John Cruddas, who has talked about the need to take up a positive conception of Englishness and warned the cosmopolitan left of the dangers of rejecting the politics of land and territory associated with the nation-state. And also returning to the show, Ash Sarkar, senior editor at Navarra Media, who has told the likes of David Starkey and Piers Morgan on countless occasions that criticising your country doesn't mean you hate it. Will it be another polarised debate, or can we strike a surprising consensus? To feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future, email podcast@anothereurope.org. You can also support the podcast by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. It's cheap as chips and makes a big difference. And in this episode, there's a fantastic discussion on the idea of communism, which is only available to members.
So let's start by looking at that distinction between patriotism and nationalism that George Orwell outlines. I'm going to quote it. By patriotism, I mean devotion to a particular place and a particular way of life, which one believes to be the best in the world, but has no wish to force on other people. Patriotism is of its nature defensive, both militarily and culturally. Nationalism, on the other hand, is inseparable from the desire for power. Do we think this distinction is meaningful and still has meaning?
Well, it's certainly influential. That particular quotation on patriotism is wielded by many people on the left with the ferocity of Tyndale's Bible. It seems to be the thing that people return to again and again when they want to make sense of the tensions between socialist politics and the nation state. But I think as pithy as it is, it's not without its limitations. And the big one that I can see in Orwell's text throughout is that he doesn't really consider colonialism, he doesn't consider anti-colonial nationalism, and he doesn't have a particularly in-depth analysis of race and racism. And so lots of this is a product of timing. Orwell's writing Notes on Nationalism in 1945, so some of the really big stuff, Indian independence, the Algerian Revolution, the Mau Mau uprising, these things haven't happened yet. But there's a lot that he could have written about and that he doesn't. And one of the big absences, really glaring absences, is the idea that notions around defending one's land, one's people, and one's way of life can themselves be a vehicle for domination and supremacist ideologies. And one of the examples that, you know, I always go back to is, if you've watched Birth of a Nation, which is a landmark in American cinematic history from 1915, it's about the formation of the Ku Klux Klan, and it frames it as a defensive project, a noble defense of American democratic virtues in the South. And this film was a hit at the time. It was shown to the Supreme Court. It was screened in the White House to Woodrow Wilson. And it even included a quote from Woodrow Wilson in the intertitles, which said, "The white men were roused by a mere instinct of self-preservation until at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, a veritable empire of the South to protect the Southern country." And the reason why I bring this up is that it highlights a wrinkle in Orwell's formulation. Don't get me wrong, I think there's a lot good about the essay. And the wrinkle is that who is seen to be a threat to a particular place and a particular way of life is often a very racialized construct, and it's also a politically contested one. And if you fall into that category of you are perceived as a racialized threat to the nation state, the idea of patriotism being, you know, a defensive and virtuous and inclusive love of place and one of country, and that makes it innocuous, it doesn't quite fit.
If we're discussing a distinction that Orwell made, we kind of have to update it if we're talking about left-wing patriotism to include left-wing patriots who would have had a different conception of that place, you know. So Orwell is talking about a place in which, one, it does present a racial threat to the order of that place. But, you know, somebody who would call themselves a left-wing patriot now would have a notion of place which was not monocultural.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but it's not the case that we speak language and it does whatever we want it to. Language also speaks through us. It has social meanings. And some of those social meanings are still shaped by the legacies from colonialism, racism, and Islamophobia. Now, I'm not saying that in order to be a really good leftist, you've got to provide the mirror image and the photo negative of British exceptionalism, which is all you can do is talk about the bad things that Britain has done or is doing or represents. In lots of ways, I'm perhaps the most obnoxious evangelist for English culture. I'm a great believer in the singular genius of Shakespeare and what have you, but my love of English literature, my love for the place where I grew up, which is London, in some ways my ferocious London tribalism, and deep sense of affinity with where I live, which is both bigger and smaller than the nation state of Britain, it's bigger and smaller than England, will never be received as being a legitimate and recognizable form of patriotism, because one of my politics, which are hostile to the status quo, which are intensely critical of Britain's history with regards to colonialism and ongoing geopolitical orientation, and because of the elements to do with race and cultural identity, the presumptions of, you know, latent treachery amongst British Muslims, the hostility towards a sense that you can have a hybrid identity, which is both deeply British and also very strongly connected to your South Asian roots. Those are all things which interrupt these feelings and these social values being recognized as legitimate patriotism. And so that's why, for me, it's not about chastising left-wing people for talking about patriotism. It's a questioning of its effectiveness, because you can say what you want and you can try and rebrand patriotism, but I think that it's understood and it's received in quite rigid terms in society at large. And that was the wall that I think Corbyn just kept running his head into. And so I just wonder really about it as a use of our time.
John, Do you accept that you're running your head against a wall?
Well, I accept it's very difficult territory. I mean, look, I mean, I'll tell you what, I agree with an awful lot of what Ash just said, actually. I just wonder whether it is in such intrinsically difficult. Is it, can it be contested in a way that it can be useful? Patriotism, nationalism. I'll be fairly blunt where I come from. I mean, my family were Irish immigrants, right? So if you talk about English patriotism to my family, they talk about Oliver Cromwell, you know, partition, slaughter, civil war. You know, these are not the most benign terms. But it just seems to me, if you understand politics as being twofold, one, it's a competition of ideas about competing models of justice, but it's also a competition for votes within defined communities, nations, territories. And so for practicing politicians who seek mandates from such communities and nations, they don't necessarily seek their mandate from a global electorate. So does he or she have certain moral obligations to those communities over and above a global electorate? And that seems to me where the potency of the ideas around patriotism are, because if politics is grounded within nation states, which they are, even more so, you could add, over the last few years. And I accept that a lot of the left see the terms community and nation as inherently loaded, simply stating that I was here first. But the danger of that is you hand these categories of community and nation over to your opponents. So going back to Orwell, one of the recurring themes of the last century was patriotism as pathology across the left, going back to, say, the Second World War. And he sort of tried to contest that, arguably quite successfully. And he started saying, well, you know, look, this is sort of the currency of a sort of rationalist left. And the danger with this is you lose the sort of potency of the emotional grip of these terms within politics. So can you contest them? Now, when I come from in the early 80s, as part of the left, was the notion of the national popular is a term that has to be used to counteract what was Thatcherite hegemony then. And I still think it's worth exhausting whether these terms can be contested in a more optimistic way. Now, I accept that patriotism, nationalism, they can be racially absolute, isolationist, exclusive terms, but are they inherently so? That's where I come at. Because the danger with that is you gift them to your opponents. And that, I think, is where you get into trouble, because you are then in a trap game whereby you've conceded a lot of the terms by which politics is defined.
One of the things that I found interesting when I was reading the essay, I think I must have read it years ago when I was a young political science student, but not at all recently. And rereading it in advance of this podcast, I was like, well, the way in which he talks about Britain, the Soviet Union and the United States as the great powers is so interesting here, because in a way they're great powers because they're basically empires at this stage. They're not nation states. They are huge global conglomerates of interests. And then he explains and counterposes what a nationalistic approach to the German question would be to a cooperative approach to the German question. And he argues that, you know, we're not going to set about annexing Germany and carving it up and so on. Now, of course, there's a lot of ironies here, because in a way, across the whole of the 20th century, we were still caught within empires. There was one American empire on one side, and there was one Soviet empire on the other side. And I think, as Ash was saying, this is a bit of a missing element in Orwell's analysis, really, because he seems to talk about expansionary nationalism, what you'd probably call colonialism, and then say all nationalism is like that. Well, really, the kind of nationalism that we're talking about today is, as John just said, it's ethnically exclusive and leads to racism in some forms, but there are also other forms of nationalism that don't have that category. And, you know, no one would, for example, really seriously suggest, whether you agree with them or not, that the Scottish National Party fit Orwell's definition of nationalism here.
One of the things that I found interesting about preparing for today is the way in which the left is riven by its own internal contradictions. And there's that particular strain of the anti-imperialist left, which is really hard on Britain and America, and, you know, often too soft on Russia, too soft on China, and tends to, in an attempt to recover, you know, a kind of subaltern history, homogenizes anti-colonial nationalism. And so that's why it's so interesting that it's not in Orwell's text, because anti-colonial nationalism was itself, you know, riven by internal contradictions, factions, the FLN in Algeria being a prime example of this, and the split between, you know, the Marxists and the Islamists. And so the interesting thing about the splits in anti-colonial nationalist movements is that they were often about one's orientation to global and transnational forms of political and religious identity. It was about your orientation geopolitically. And I think that's something that's missing when we sort of relentlessly focus on the question of nationalism in the global north, is that there are other societies, other countries which have dealt with these questions and arrived at very, very different answers.
I'm still quite interested in that question, because I think, you know, I completely agree, Ash, that there are kind of nationalist movements that are a reaction to oppressive regimes are by definition not expansionist in and of themselves. They're kind of a resistant, they're resisting previous expansions. So it's sort of an unfair characterization. But there are certainly people who think of Scottish nationalism as, if not an expansionist force, then to have the kind of narrowness that we associate with nationalism. But are we kind of all agreed that that is not true of the SNP?
Well, there's been historically, there has been parts of that within it. You can compare that to, say, Tom Nairn's view over the last 20 years has been that Scottish nationalism is a protective thing against the rapacious nature of globalisation. And it is a politics of resistance encased within national boundaries. And that can take radical progressive forms, even though that's not to deny the legacies, the history, the culture, the inheritance that you operate within. Obviously within the spirit of the nature of colonialism as well. My simple point is this is complex territory which should be contested on the left rather than simply written off as illegitimate categories to try and operationalise and build political projects around.
Would you agree that talking about what the SNP have done as a kind of form of resistance to globalisation in Scotland, that it was a way to talk about anti-neoliberalism but linked it to identity, you feel that that was missing, presumably, in England?
And totally. And I understand why. Because of the loaded, you know, history and the inheritance. I mean, look, I feel everyone feels this profoundly on the left. You know, I do. I mean, I was brought up in sort of cultures of Irish nationalism, which were very, very different to this notion of, you know, English patriotism and, you know, blah, blah, blah. The sort of Billy Bragg territory. That's not where I'm coming from at all. But I understand and I respect what, you know, his sort of way of tiptoeing through it. It just means that it's a live one rather than something you discontinue as a political conversation. So I think we should bring in, and that has been a sort of drumbeat of the last 100 years, which is a sort of notion on the left of the mob at the gate. Do you know what I mean? There is a sort of sense of a sort of Simpsons thing with everyone's there. And there's always been, since the early part of the last century, this fear on the progressive left that this gets into territory where those uneducated working class people start getting involved in politics, and that can rear off in very dangerous ways. We need to control the terms of this debate, you know.
So, Ash, the argument there is that really that nationalism is kind of this dynamic phenomenon.
I mean, look, and I can understand the temptation in particular coming from Labour. You look at what the SNP have been able to do, which is, you know, fashion a progressive majority which links both metropolitan areas and former industrial heartlands together. And you go, oh, why can't we have a bit of that? And one of the main reasons is the particular social forces at work in England. And I suppose, you know, I've been quite interested to look at the work that John Denham has done around ideas of an English Parliament. And I think one of the things that's missing is that nationalism isn't the only solution at hand for rebalancing of regional inequalities, whether those inequalities are ones of investment, of a stake in the national conversation, wealth, or anything else. You know, England is incredibly skewed towards London in terms of both being a financial centre, a cultural centre, and the focus of obsessive political coverage. You don't have the kind of spread across different poles of attraction that you do in the States, for instance, in American media. And you certainly have a absolutely chronic underrepresentation of the concerns of Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales in this London-centric media, but also of anything that falls outside of the scope of a handful of political editors, journalists and producers who, you know, occupy the same three tube stops in central London. And I think that that's something which drives the sense of a country that's out of joint and a country that's imbalanced. And I do question whether nationalism is the right vehicle. And by right, I don't mean morally right. I mean the effective vehicle for dealing with that phenomenon. But also, as for the thing about, you know, some of the left suspicion of nationalism comes from a suspicion, you know, oh, those working class people over there. Well, my grandma coming to this country, my mum in this country, they were as the working class, right? My grandma came over to be a carer in a hospital. You know, her and my mum were part of, you know, the Black and Asian caucuses and the trade union movement. And at the same time, they were experiencing, you know, the legacy of powerism in this country with really violent consequences. So I don't think it's about a sort of patrician desire to control the unruly mob. It's looking at the particular vulnerabilities of those hyper-exploitable workers who make up the British working class and who make up the global working class, and thinking about, you know, how do you shape a workers' movement which isn't just inclusive of those people in a kind of condescending sense, but puts them at the forefront of it?
So, John, you were one of the people who pushed the idea of Englishness and national identity in the Labour Party in the first bit of the last decade. There's this interesting interview in the New Statesman from 2012 with Stuart Hall, the founder of Cultural Studies. Hall says you met him to talk about it. He doesn't exactly endorse you, but he does say he gets where you were coming from. Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Went up to his house. We had some conversations about all of this. I grew up as an ardent follower of Marx and Today and Stuart, and was very influenced in his diagnosis of Thatcherism and its economic, political, cultural dominance, and how it had to be contested with a national popular contest, which tried to redraw the terms and learn from the dominance of what confronted us in the early 80s. Now, the terms of debate we had was, is that so encased with a certain history and such a loaded terms of reference that it's irretrievable? That's the basic question, isn't it? And I came at it from a specific, I mean, look, my approach was one of, in the early 80s, being involved in a lot of Euro-communist movements as part of that non-doctrinaire authoritarian left that tried to learn from some Southern European Euro-communist movements that were trying to contest the national popular, especially within Spain and Italy. And how adaptable, how, you know, transportable is that sort of politics for today? Or this was 10 years ago in the Labour Party, given the austerity politics and given learning from Labour's history, in that you could make the argument that it only wins when it successfully contests the national story, like 45, 64, 97. And what would be the elements to try and do that in the early 2000s? Now, and again, to repeat, I don't come from this from a sort of English exceptionalist history. On the contrary, actually. But it just seems to me that we just need to try. Because if you look 10 years on, what's situated underneath the sort of the purchase of authoritarian populism is their ability to redesign the terms of national popular politics. And they are winning everywhere. And the left is in, you know, in decline across Western market economies and beyond. And is that something to do with abstracting from the terms of national popular political contest? And I would say that possibly is. Now, he would say, I think at the time his argument would be these terms are so loaded that it's not possible to reimagine their use in a radical, progressive, hopeful way. Whereas I'm not too sure. And I think 10 years on, we've seen the collateral damage of our inability to do so, actually.
So, Ash, I want to bring you in to respond to this and also to give you the opportunity to say there's something that Stuart Hall says in this interview that I'm pretty sure that you're going to agree with, but maybe you could explain to us why. He says at one point, "I do think Englishness, as John was just saying, is something we need to talk about, but it's a contested terrain that is structured powerfully against a contemporary radical appropriation." And, you know, as someone who is probably as cosmopolitan and alternative globalist as you could ever imagine, I must admit that I think that there is something in what John is saying here, because doesn't all politics have to come back to some notion of place? And when you come back to that notion of place, doesn't that require some kind of identity? And in a way, there's something that Hall tells us about studying culture that leads us to those conclusions as well.
I mean, I'm certainly not for one second advocating that you completely abandon the terrain of mass political culture and mass political participation. You know, I've had my flirtation with the sort of super horizontalist anarchist left, and I quite fancy eating things that aren't hummus and talking to more than six people at once. And that's how I've found myself in the position that I am now. So I do think that you have to talk about the country. And I'm not one of those people that's tremendously bothered by, you know, Keir Starmer or anyone else's attempts to recover some of the language of patriotism. I'm not one of those people that goes, aha, you've revealed the problematic bone in your body. It's for me about, you know, what are the costs going to be of having your patriotism be recognized? And that's where I think Stuart Hall comes in. There's a cost to entering the field of legitimate patriotism. And it will often be, in order to enter that room and to be recognized as belonging there, you've got to give something up in your critique. And I think that's especially true now, you know, more so than it was decades in the past, simply because we're operating in a political terrain in which the institutions which were capable of leveraging working class power outside of the electoral system have been demolished. They've been decimated. And so I think we're framing some of these discussions as if they will take place in an environment where there will be a presumption of good faith, you know, that there won't be. And so where notions of, you know, national identity, I think, are now being redrawn on ever more exclusionary lines. And, you know, you see some of the flirtations with ethno-nationalism creep into the discourse of the mainstream right. You know, I wonder what it is we would have to give up in order to be seen to be contesting, you know, that field of patriotism. And now as for Stuart Hall, I think I'm like everyone else on this podcast. I'm a Stuart Hall stan. Love Stuart Hall. You know, other people have pictures of Britney Spears on their wall. I had Stuart Hall. There's a phenomenal picture of him at a disco wearing a crop top. I think he's with Lynn Segal, and it's one of my favorite photos of all time. It's one of the things which I sort of balk at, is that I understand that sometimes strategically you've got to leave some of the sacred cows of British history alone, you know, strategically trying to question the legacy of Churchill might not be a smart move, particularly if what you're trying to do is win the terrain of the future rather than relitigate the events of the past. But when it's your great-grandfather who was in prison during the famine and your grandmother's talking about what it was like being a child in Bengal during that time, it's not quite so easy to write off. And it's certainly difficult to participate in some of the collective gatherings of celebration and memorial and so on and so forth. And the interesting thing is that I think that this alternative idea of a diverse, subversive notion of Englishness and Britishness is that where you do see it done successfully is in the field of Black British pop culture. You know, I'm thinking about grime. You know, Kano does an album, Made in the Manor, with a title track, This Is England. Skepta, Wiley are defined by their very particular and peculiar senses of Englishness, because they're kind of pushing up against the behemoth that is American rap. And so I guess that's why I find sometimes the agonizing about it in political settings a bit tiresome, because I'm like, oh, this is being achieved really well in pop culture.
It's actually what I always thought about the Labour Party trying out patriotism, is that it was the exact opposite of grime. It seemed like it was doing it under pressure and it didn't really know how to do it. Whereas, as you say, pop culture, when it does it, it means it. Ed Miliband did this famous conference speech in 2012 where he announced One Nation Labour, and everybody loved it and it was very well delivered and he didn't use notes and he seemed relaxed for the first time and made a lot of explicitly patriotic notes.
A vision of Britain, a vision of Britain where patriotism, loyalty, dedication to the common cause courses through the veins of all and nobody feels left out.
It also did seem quite contentless, and if you kind of tie it together with his later flirtations with kind of, I am definitely against immigration, here is my mug, he seemed like a person who was trying on the clothes but didn't like them. And it didn't seem to be his natural attire. And I think exactly the same of Jeremy Corbyn. You know, he periodically tried to talk about patriotism and say he was a patriot, but it just didn't seem real from him. And I think it was that more than the messages themselves that people balked at.
So, John, this question of how do you do it organically is going to be really important, because doing it in a fake and insincere way or a contentless way leads to a whole other set of problems than the ones we had in the first place.
The Ed Miliband thing is quite instructive, actually, because that One Nation speech came after he'd been kicked around for about 18 months for trying to push back around predatory capitalism. And he was trying to talk about a sort of different type of nation building, you know, to challenge some of the predatory neoliberal dispossession that was occurring, trying to rethink a radical new architecture to the economy. And basically all of that radicalism, the possibilities around it, gradually got squeezed out because of the professional political apparatus around it. So, I mean, I think there were a series of possibilities from 2011, 2012 to break with some of what had happened at the end of the whole New Labour era, that sort of cold Labour utilitarianism. He was trying to push back against it and trying to push back against some of the orthodoxies of austerity. Unfortunately, he got a bit ahead in the polls too early, and then all of the professionals sort of crowded out those opportunities. So I see it as a sort of slightly sad tale of a path not travelled, really. But, and also, I suppose, there is this sort of synthetic thing. He looked like more of a sort of Beltway special advisor from North London who was trying to dance, you know, around that sort of that national popular story, you know, and it didn't quite fit and it wasn't him. You know, so does that look even worse if it's not in any way recognisable within your sort of political DNA? Probably, yeah. And that, maybe that's true with Corbyn as well, to go back to Zoe's point.
I mean, the Corbyn thing I find quite funny, because there is no other culture that could have produced him other than England, yeah. Right? His yeah, idiosyncrasies yeah. are so deeply,
he
deeply...
He is a very English political figure. Yeah.
English. Yeah. You know, and so that's one of the things that I find hilarious. I mean, come on, the allotments, the manhole covers, yeah. the cap, you know, his sort of, you know, cultural vocabulary, his... And then also the history which he appeals to. And I'm not just talking about, you know, when he's trying to, you know, shore up his patriotic credentials in a hostile political environment. But I remember in 2017 at The World Transformed, you know, he did that typical Jeremy thing. If he was meant to talk for 2 minutes and he gave a 40-minute speech starting with you know, the enclosures through to the Chartist movement and so on and so forth, you know. And so it's this real passion for that radical socialism from below thread of English history. And it's something which is particularly English.
Well, this is so interesting. I mean, sorry to cut in, but I just agree with you so strongly because I think there is this, there's a real tradition within leftist politics of English people who hate English, who are kind of very much rooted in the directly post-colonial and mid-colonial times. So people like my mum's generation, that part of being English for them is launching really stern critiques of Englishness. And I worry, per John's point, that if we kind of step off the terrain of patriotism rather than say that's as English as Colonel Tom Moore, then we're losing something, because we're part of the national story as well. And, you know, people who are born in the 30s and 40s and raised on a diet of Orwell and hate colonialism and identified the left as a kind of, as an attempt to overturn that expansionism, they are, you know, they're England too. I was just thinking, because my mum was complaining that she didn't get enough exercise because she's not allowed out because she's so old. And my husband said, why don't you just walk around, do laps of your garden to raise money for Hamas? And it was a real joke. It was a real kind of Starmer left versus Benite left joke. But it is very much part of the Labour tradition to be her and, you know, to be the butt of that joke. But you know, if we say we've got no time to talk about what Englishness is, then we lose a lot of how that story.
I agree with you, but I think there's another aspect to this, which is also how national stories are sustained over time and what kind of social infrastructures in society they need to sustain them. Because is it the case that the reason that Corbyn is not recognised as for his Englishness, as Ash says, is because Corbyn didn't talk enough about his Englishness? Or is it because the kinds of the society that could sustain his idea of Englishness or recognise it or adapt to it, I mean, changed out of all recognition? So he found himself to be, strangely, as far as his ideology was concerned, very, you know, had a great deal of resonance in the big cities, but not in the industrial heartlands or ex-industrial heartlands now, where his politics cut its teeth in the 1970s and 80s.
You go back to the whole history of the ILP, which is literally came out of the provinces, if you will, and it spoke to, it had its own sort of anti-Semitism, Morris, Ruskin, whatever. And you can chart certain tributaries to the Second World War within different traditions of a distinct English socialist idiom, you know, culturally, economically, regionally. And the danger now is, there's another debate around this, of course, which is, debates around the future of the left almost create a coalition of the winners outside of that history, which is urban, educated, has a greater proximity to knowledge-based work and education. And it's, you know, the left is being redrawn in terms of its coalition, especially since the last election, especially in the aftermath of Brexit, actually, totally against that whole history about it's, and I mean traditional here in terms of its relations to the traditional means of production. I don't mean a traditional white working class identity. I mean a specific form of class politics that has been redrawn literally in the last couple of years. And the paradox of that is, under the auspices of Corbyn, there are very strong continuities with the Blair Project within that, which has redrawn the character of the left voting bloc as a voting bloc of winners rather than, you know, its traditional coalition.
Isn't that also to do with, you know, the sort of transformation of wealth generation in this country, you know, not being a productive economy anymore? And, you know, within those red wall seats, the sort of, you know, typical red to blue voter was a homeowner, you know, was less well off compared to voters in London, but, you know, relative to, you know, young people in the area, had an asset which is appreciating in value. And so I think it's not just sort of about cultural traditions and cultural affinity. I think it's also to do with Thatcher's, decades-long project of, you know, fashioning class composition in a way that you had an expanded pool of conservative voters, and also the emergence of, you know, a white-collar precariat, and also an invisibilized working class, the sort of breakup of strongholds of working class power and the sort of dispersed nature of that workforce now. I think, not to be that vulgar Marxist who's like, oh, you're being insufficiently materialist, comrade, but I think that stuff has got a bit to do with it.
John, to go back to what you said earlier, actually, about the early part of the last decades and the conversation you had with Stuart Hall, clearly over the last 8 years since, you will say that quite a lot of things that have happened, as you said earlier, have proven you correct. I was wondering, what would you pick out and say, are there things that you got wrong in this period?
I suppose virtually everything in the last decade. A succession of defeats, for and abouts. I thought Corbyn had energy because he stood outside of what went before, and it could have been a much more potent political force than it turned out to be last year. I got that wrong. I thought he could tap into something, and he did it in 2017, obviously, but then the whole Brexit thing sort of blindsided a lot of that. What I've totally missed, actually, in the last decade is, outside of parts of the Corbynite left, parts of it, and they in turn got a bit taken over by the more traditional authoritarian type, there was no attempt to renew across the centre and the right of the Labour Party. I find that an extraordinary thing with hindsight over the last, literally, you could say 15 years, there's been no active process of reimagining social democracy, apart from some radical new generation thinking in and around Corbynism, which I disagree with, but I like because of its energy and vitality, you know? And the real tragedy for me is just the dead hand in and around so much of Labour rather than the left, actually. And I got that wrong because I did think it would have sufficient game in it that it could get out from under that whole what was happening the back end of the 2000s, early 2010s, you know, but it never did. It just did not have the wherewithal. There was no renewal, even amongst the defeated factions across the whole Labour Party, which is an absolute tragedy to me in terms of the shrinking of a political tradition.
And what do you think about Starmer in that context?
He's symptomatic of it. Starmer, I mean, I don't want to die, but in any leader of the Labour Party, you would look back on a sort of record of interventions, contributions, articles, speeches, books, whatever. There's a sort of trail, an evidence trail to their political character. Now, he hasn't got that. Now, he's therefore playing into the sort of lowest common denominator unity card, which has sufficed to date. So there are possibilities because it's such a sort of unknown. And that is symptomatic of the shrinking of a political tradition to me.
I think that's absolutely right, because it's so interesting that you say that. As you might have noticed from his campaign, you know, it said another future is possible, which was a clear sign that he was looking around the left and thinking, hey, I need some ideas here. I've got a leadership campaign to run. Who's got the ideas? I know, where does the centre of gravity lie in the Labour Party? There's this journalist, Zoe Williams. Maybe I could get her to write something. I think she's involved in a campaign. They've been quite successful at winning positions at conference. What do these people think? Like, what's their centre of gravity ideologically? How do I run a campaign that looks as much like Corbyn as possible, but then takes everyone else with me? Oh, I know, we'll do this. And you're completely right. It's a total sign that the right in the Labour Party did not have any kind of intellectual infrastructure that they could turn around to him and say, you know what, here's the ideas, here's the policy, and here's what you should be, here's your messaging, go.
I mean, I'm a baby member, you know. I only joined reluctantly in November so I could be of more use during the general election. And I think we'll look back on that as more of a hindrance than a help, even if the heart was in the right place. But, you know, I think where Corbyn was a totem, Starmer is a cipher. And I think that one of the things that he may have done is look at the sort of overexposure of Corbyn by 2019, because I think that that was one of the things that really hamstrung the campaign, is that everyone felt that they knew him. Moral integrity, which is what had, you know, swept him to the leadership position in 2015 and sustained him in 2016 and had defied expectations in 2017, had been tarnished, had been, you know, under relentless assault. And, you know, some of the criticisms obviously were fair, but many of them were not. And, you know, after 4 years of that being slung at a politician, it's hard to come out on top in a general election where you've got, you know, a fresher face with, you know, a lot more favorable public reception. So as frustrating as I do find it to sort of not know much of Starmer and to feel in some sense a great deal of absence, particularly around coronavirus, maybe that's the right thing to do. And I suppose if you come out of a year like 2019 thinking you've got all the answers to what went wrong, you know, you're probably a psychopath. And so the approach I'm taking now is maybe if I really don't like this, the country will.
Oh, Ash, don't say
no,
that.
I'm serious.
I still think you've got a really good read on. I really do think you've got a really good read on what people will react to emotionally. You know, that moment with Piers Morgan where he asked you if there's anything you liked about Englishness and you said the crisp sandwich. I still think about that most days.
There's not a day that goes by where I didn't think about crisp sandwiches.
Me neither, thanks to you.
You're now moving into members-only material for this podcast. Thanks so much for supporting the campaign. It really does make a huge difference in these tough times. So we can now go into the final bit of extra time and have a cheer around of another New Statesman article. The New Statesman is doing well in terms of its the battery of ideas that is provided for this episode of the podcast. So, John, like, you wrote a provocative, some might say demagogic, but powerful critique of the challenge of the rise of what you called cyborg socialism on what some people like Ash call fully automated luxury communism.
Aaron calls it that. I don't call it that.
Well, you know, I'm in favour of partially automated, socially just. Anyway, so John, what's your critique of cyborg socialism?
My thing about the left, it partly goes back to our conversation about the early 80s, actually. The battle was against the deterministic authoritarian left, who had a specific reading of history through their approach to a specific appropriation of Marx and the laws of history and technological change and the forces of production, which is, to me, a bastardization of Marx and the labor theory of value, da 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 da. And my fear is that even though it is the site of energy and vitality, as I mentioned on in and around Corbyn, around debates around post-capitalism and accelerationism and all of that, there's a danger as the same determinism is reappearing on the modern left. And that is dangerous. So, for example, if you look at the history of the left, debates around science fiction, say Huxley, Orwell, they saw the development of technological capacity as endangering humanity rather than it foreseeing a new utopia. And it sort of upends some of that history of humanism on the left. And especially when it gets into debates around cyborg augmentation and post-humanism, then there's dangerous eugenic overtones to me. So I sort of read some of the acceleration stuff and recoiled with horror. And I also read, I like Paul Mason, I like his work, I like the luxury communism notion, but it's just the specific rereading of the dominance of technological change over class struggle, if you want, or the politics of contesting the form that technology takes. And it's, in the guise of utopia, it throws up to me a dystopian politics.
Ash, you're not a fully automated luxury communist, but you are a communist. So tell us why.
So I'm a communist because I do think that aspects of Marx's work and the fragment on machines in particular offers glimpses of how things could be and a life freed up for the pursuit of human flourishing and for people to discover the multitudes that they contain is a huge part of what drives me to think of what a better world could look like. So on the one hand, I think it's, you know, obviously wanting to achieve truly democratic goals and break up the concentration of power in the hands of the wealthy. But also more than that, thinking about what life can be like where we don't have to, you know, sell nearly so much of our labor power in order to survive. I think that is a utopian impulse that drives me. I was describing it to a mate of mine last night as think about how many novels have been lost because a single mum had to go to her second job. Think about how many pieces of music have been lost, pieces of artwork. Directors never made a film because they couldn't afford a camera and they didn't have the time to shoot and to edit. And so thinking about creative endeavour, you know, free of work, right? And in some ways it's this kind of Milton idea of toil but not work. It is something that drives me. But, you know, I agree. I'm not much of a post-humanist. I think that Aaron's book lays out some of what the fields of contestation will be, you know, new sites of struggle, new sites of extractive capital, and urges the left to get there first in thinking about it. But I think that when it comes to thinking through the political solutions, the political vehicles for doing so, I think it's not fully developed yet. And so I'd like to see him return to some of those ideas if he ever logs off Twitter. And I think that, you know, the critique of extractive capital with regard to the global South, again, isn't quite there yet. And I think there's also a feminist critique of fully automated luxury communism, which is you have had successive waves of automation in terms of domestic labor that hasn't necessarily meant the withering away of a patriarchal organization of society. So I do have my criticisms of the book, but I do think we need utopian horizons. I think we really need them. I think that we should bear in mind that the project of the left isn't just the amelioration of suffering. Of course it is, but it's not just the amelioration of suffering. It's also the pursuit of pleasure and joy and love and collective endeavor. It's things which should be fun and enriching.
It never caught on, unfortunately, but Emmanuel Wallerstein wrote
what a fun
fun never did catch on for some of us.
Luke, no, calls for an end to fun.
I've been at parties with you, Luke. Don't lie to me. Tearing up the dance floor.
Including in lockdown era. Emmanuel Wallerstein wrote a book that, if I tell you why it never caught on and what it was called, you will realise he came up with this idea called utopistics. And clearly that's never going to catch on as a thing, but as an alternative to utopia. But he had quite a nice claim that has always resonated with me since, which was basically utopias are quite dangerous. And I would say the notion of communism contains this danger for Wallerstein because it always contains this end justifies the means logic. If you have this idea that there is one final society rather than a more sort of complicated evolution of many societies where different systems will overlap with one another and contain elements of the systems that come before and then also contain elements of future systems, and there's this kind of endless sort of process of evolution. And I think that sort of better captures what you were talking about, Ash, as the utopian impulse in a way, because your idea and vision is always related to your circumstances because you're a pragmatist and you're a democrat, so you keep relating the ideal to what is possible now.
And if I didn't, I wouldn't have joined the Labour Party, right? That was a compromise.
The Labour Party is a compromise. I totally agree with you. I mean, I don't disagree with any of the utopias that you search for in terms of love, fulfilment, happiness, a sense of common endeavour, all of that. My concern with that literature, as I read it, was it simply re-hates, actually partly through a specific reading through the fragment of the machines, actually, a technologist reading of history. And there's dangers in that, as we all know, in terms of having a sense of foreseeing the future and the false hopes that that entails. And the more mundane thing around, and I think it's more of a politics that has been born out of loss and failure, really. And it's a sort of indictment on what went before, because it has to its recourse is to that type of scientific thinking through a specific appropriation of technology rather than a more humane search for human fulfillment rather than technological provision, you know.
So this has been an incredibly consensual discussion for something that was pitched in the script as a fight. So, and we've all agreed that technology is a site of contestation and doesn't in itself contain a particularly revolutionary or particularly regressive element, right? We're all kind of on the same page there. You can imagine the technological developments that Aaron and others talk about in this literature being used in the most fantastically reactionary ways.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what Shoshana Zuboff writes about in Surveillance right. Capitalism. Right. And I think, you know, it's interesting that Aaron doesn't quite deal with the nature of surveillance in the book. And he talks about, you know, information wanting to be free in this very utopian vision of technology, but sort of shies away from some of those questions.
Rifkin, in his book Zero Marginal Cost Society, literally says surveillance doesn't matter. He says that young people today aren't really bothered about surveillance. Look, they're sharing all of their lives online and just moves on. It's like, what the hell? Like, this is such a crazy thing to say. I can't believe that. What an argument.
I know, but have you tried explaining to a 12-year-old why they shouldn't put their entire life online? I was trying to explain it to my son the other day, and I was kind of trying to say, you know, you never know whether your enthusiasms will turn into something else. Minecraft might be really Nazi in 5 years, and then you'll have a load of Minecraft stuff. And it, like, PewDiePie is now a Nazi. You don't want to be a PewDiePie follower on your social media. And he looked at me and said, that's the kind of thing a crazy person would say.
I mean, I've got a list of people where I've just said, if they do anything bad or problematic, don't tell me. I just want to be able to stand them in peace. So, you know, don't ever let me know if Nigella Lawson does a PewDiePie. I don't want to know. Don't hurt me with that information. But I was just about to say something really creepy. Can I say something really creepy?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this podcast is really funny for me, because when I was doing politics at sixth form, and it was like I just started this new sixth form and doing politics, and we had to write about something that had happened at each of the party conferences. And it was in like our first term. And I wrote something about something you'd said at conference, John. And it was just this really funny thing of like, oh my God, I'm doing a podcast with someone who I literally did my homework on.
What was it?
I think I'm trying to remember the specific about what it was about. It was a piece on like what the potential for like a left-wing revival within the Labour Party would be like, and I very confidently predicted that John would be at the centre of it.
Which I think you are, John.
Your capacities for prediction have not improved with age.
The best thing to do is get me to make a prediction and then bet on the opposite.
All right. Well, thank you,
guys.
Thank you both so much.
Nice to talk to you.
Good to chat. Bye. Bye.